Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett. I'm the producer of The Humanist Hour. And this holiday season, sometimes I come up a little bit short with all of the craziness going on with me and the people that I'd like to interview. So instead of giving you an hour of dead air or skipping an episode, both of which aren't very attractive options, I thought, why not play my positive humanism speech that I gave a couple weeks ago in front of a local humanist group in Concord, Massachusetts. It goes about an hour, so it seems just perfect. So once again, next week, we will be resuming with the usual Humanist Hour podcast interviews. But for this week, for the last Humanist Hour podcast of 2014, I'd like to leave you with my presentation on positive humanism. Have a great new year, everybody.
Thank you. How's everyone doing tonight? Good, good. I'm happy to be here. Thank you for the invitation. I'll be talking to you tonight about positive humanism. How many of you have heard of this term before? Not too many. Okay. One. Good, good. Well, I'll be talking... We'll get to that. Hold your questions. My book is available in the back. It's free. I did a first printing. When I do some printings, I'll just print the first one to see how they turn out. The cover was a little bit off. I had to change some things, but go ahead and take the book and enjoy it. There's a few copies left. No charge. So tonight's talk is on positive humanism, and I'd like to start by talking a little bit about myself first to show you how I came about positive humanism. Like many of you, I was raised in a religious household. I was raised Catholic by two non-Catholic parents, if you want to call them that. They were they weren't traditional Catholics. They didn't go to church all the time, but they were more cultural Catholics. How many of you fit in that category here? Not just Catholicism, but were brought up in an environment where it's just more the kind of the thing you did. All right. I come from a very entrepreneurial background as well. My dad was an inventor. My brother had his screen printing business. My sister was in real estate. And I kind of picked that up. I could say that I never got into any kind of alcohol or drugs. That certainly wasn't my scene. But I did have a drug of choice, and that was Tony Robbins. You guys familiar with Tony Robbins? Motivator, positive speaker. He was one of my inspirations, basically. When I was working with my father, I was just kind of bored in the kind of monotonous type of stuff I had to do. So I took some of my sister's tapes. My sister had a whole bunch of tapes being in the real estate industry. So I would listen to them, pseudo-scientific ramblings from Dennis Waitley, Zig Ziglar, Tony Robbins, you name it. It was very motivating and very inspirational for me personally. Now, about 20 years later or so, I would say I reached financial success for the first time. And that's when I sold my business. I sold my first web hosting business. How many of you know what web hosting is? Good. You know, if I asked that question 20 years ago, nobody would raise their hand. And that was the time when I actually started this business. When I had a web hosting business and nobody knew what it was, I was one of the very few people. So unfortunately, at the time, it was very hard to get business. But because I was riding that wave at the right time, things worked out pretty well for me. So I was able to sell my company for a very good price. And at that time, I was able to kind of retire if I wanted to, be financially independent, which is a wonderful feeling, by the way. And that was at age 29. So when you're in this position, you're wondering, all right, what do I do now? What do I do now with my life? So I thought, well, I have two very young kids at the time that just brought into the world. And they were... You know, I wanted to leave them something. I wanted to make sure, you know, heaven forbid, if anything ever happened to me, I want to make sure that the knowledge that I have accumulated, some of the ideas could be passed on to them. So I decided to write a book called Year to Success. And this was a very big book, nothing like this book. It was 760 pages, very thick, very big. And writing this book, basically it was my personal story of how I succeeded, but along with kind of the cumulative knowledge of hundreds of different success gurus over the years. So in writing that book, what I did was I had to go back and listen to a lot of these programs again and read a lot of these books. And when I was doing that, I started to realize, wow, a lot of these guys are just full of crap. And it never really hit me before, because I started I was kind of born into that, and starting at age 10 listening to it, I just kind of grew up with it. So something new ignited in me, and it was critical thinking. But that was just the beginning. So when writing my book, I have to admit, it was a year-long process, and there's still some things that I'm not too proud of that's in that book that I look at now and I say, oh boy, you know, why did I write that? But I did, and that was 10 years ago. We move on. I write new books. It was a very interesting process. And then the next 10 years, I would speak about many different issues, mostly success. I would be invited to companies to speak about different aspects of success and achievement. And I realized that while I was doing this, it was very difficult for me to say some of the things that I would say previously, and I was very comfortable saying them. As my level of critical thinking started to rise, my ability to BS with the self-help crap started to go down. So at one point, I just threw in the towel. I said, I can't do this anymore. I just can't. But I really had a passion for communication, so I started a podcast called Marketing Bull. A podcast is kind of like an online radio show where I basically deconstructed a lot of the bull that goes on in marketing and in business. And that kind of kept my pulse in the industry. So some time would pass, and I decided to put these critical thinking skills to use in the area of religion and spirituality, because that's something I never really thought of before. Sure, I grew up Catholic. I got confirmed in eighth grade. I went to church when I had to, but then I was done. At that time, using today's terminology back then, I would probably be considered a nun. Have you heard that term before, N-O-N-E? It means basically you don't have any religion and you just don't care. You just don't go to church. You don't consider yourself secular or non-religious. You're just nothing. You're a nun. So what happened? I did this whole spiritual journey when a friend of mine asked me about Jesus. He said, Bo, have you discovered Jesus? And I said, I don't know. You know, what does that mean? I understand. I know the guy. I heard of him. But what do you mean by that? So he gave me a book by Lee Strobel. Have you heard of him before? He's a Christian author who writes about a lot of apologetics, what it's called, trying to sell somebody on religion. And I read it, and again, my level of skepticism went up a little bit. And I wasn't very comfortable reading that. But I decided that it was probably something worth looking into, because apparently my eternal soul was on the line. I don't know if you heard that line before. So I said, okay, geez, if that's on the line, I better look into this thing. So I spent 3 years of my life, 3 full years devoted full time to exploring religion, exploring mostly Christianity, but other religions as well, exploring philosophy, the philosophy related to religion. And it really was an interesting journey. The journey ended by me reading the Bible cover to cover. I don't know if any of you have ever taken that task on, but it's a tough one. It took 8 months. And as I'm flipping through the last pages and closing the cover, metaphorically, of course, because I read it on ebook, as I'm closing the metaphorical cover, at that time, that's when I realized that, yes, I'm an atheist. And you know what? Reading the Bible tends to do that to people. So I started a website called debategod.org. Debate God was where I put a lot of resources for other people going through the same kind of journey. People who wanted to explore religion, but not from a one-sided aspect. People who wanted to explore religion fairly and hear the Christian arguments from Christians and hear the atheistic arguments from atheists. The best way to do that is definitely debate, audio debates. You get the best arguments and you get fair arguments. So I had a collection of over 1,000 hours I put together on this website. I also started a forum, which is like a discussion forum where people go online to talk and debate about things, on that website where people would share ideas about their religion and their beliefs. And I noticed a transformation. I started to become what many people call an angry atheist. I don't know if any of you have ever been in that boat. Maybe some of you are in that boat now. It's when you're angry at pretty much everything. You're angry at religious people for the things that they say and the claims that they make. You're angry at your parents for making you go through 10 years of religious school. you're just angry at a lot of different things, and it comes out in pretty much everything you do, and especially in your communication. And frankly, I didn't like that person I was becoming. And I'll certainly say that there are room for people like that, and if anybody is like that, then okay, but that just wasn't me. And I realized that at one point, and I said, I cannot go back to being the self-help guru, because that's just the point of no return. I passed that. I can't go back to doing that, and I can't be the angry atheist. So I decided, and I looked, and I thought about some kind of philosophy, put things together, and that's when I decided, well, I think I'll become a positive humanist. And that's what we're going to be talking about today. Basically, I wanted to compile a very simple secular philosophy that would be an easy transition for people of religion, especially Christianity. And that's pretty much what positive humanism is all about. So here's the definition. Positive humanism is an applied secular humanistic philosophy based on the scientific findings of positive psychology that focuses on personal, professional, and societal flourishing. So what I'm doing is I'm going to tell you what positive humanism is, and I'm also going to tell you what it's not. The philosophy is grounded in the theories of positive psychology, which we'll talk about in more detail in a bit, which is the study of the positive side of the mental health spectrum, which we call human flourishing. Okay, here's what positive humanism is not. Positive humanism is not anti-religion. It is, however, anti-humanism. Now, there are parts of religion that are very anti-humanism. Does anybody want to throw out some ideas, throw out some parts of religion that could be considered anti-humanism?
War.
War, religious, right, holy war, sure.
Burka.
I'm sorry?
Burka.
Burkas, okay, yes, forcing women to wear burkas.
Original sin.
Original sin, oh my goodness. The idea that all of us are dirty, sinful people. When I look at you, you're not a human being. You're a dirty, sinful person who is deserving of eternal punishment. Eternal punishment. That's how some people see other humans. That has to be the least humanistic value I could even possibly imagine.
Hell.
Yeah. But we can't judge a whole religion based on these certain aspects of anti-humanism elements that are in religion. We have to look at all of religion. And in fairness, we could look at religion and think of very positive aspects. Does anybody want to name some very positive humanistic aspects of religion?
Charities.
Religion, community building,
compassion,
sure. Okay, these are especially a lot of principles that they talk about in Christian religions. Forgiveness, that's another wonderful thing. So what we have to do is we have to look at all of religion, and we have to make judgments based on that. And from a psychological perspective, looking at how religion does affect people, I could say that overall, I really do believe that religion is a good thing. It is a force of good, at least in this country. I can't speak for religion everywhere in the world, but that's the conclusion I have come to. You may disagree, and that's fine. We all have different background information that could bring us to different conclusions. But what positive humanism doesn't do is it doesn't really engage in debate. It's not about confronting people of different religions and trying to talk them out of their religion or saying how their religion is wrong. You know, I've done that. I've been there. I've done 3 years of that. And again, I didn't like doing that. But it's necessary sometimes. And there is a place for that. But it's just not a place in positive humanism. Very often within positive humanism or any kind of humanism, when you're trying to communicate your thoughts and your beliefs, you do have to disassemble some beliefs that are out there. And that's just necessary at times. But if you do it with a certain sense of diplomacy, then that's a good path. Positive humanism is not for everybody. In research in the area of religion suggests that places where religion is very popular, believe it or not, people who practice religion tend to have a higher sense of well-being. And that's what the research shows. And again, as a social scientist, I can't look at that research and say, that's a bunch of crap, because I'm a humanist and I think that's better. You can't do that. You have to look at things objectively. You have to follow the science, follow the evidence where it is. But I'll be talking about that in some more detail and see how that makes sense. And there are certainly people from very religious communities who let's just say if they adopted a secular philosophy, they would have a much lower sense of well-being. Just imagine, I don't know if any of you fit in this category, but if you're from a family that's incredibly religious, you're a very close-knit family, and they believe that you are going to hell if you don't believe what they do, and they will hate you for it. And some people are like that. So you could basically disassociate yourself with your family, with your spouse, with your children. You could lose your job. I mean, in some parts of the country, we're here in Massachusetts, we could say whatever we want, basically. Very liberal area. I think Massachusetts is usually ranked number 4 in the country for the least religious state. But there are other religious states that are extremely religious, and they just don't have it the way we do. So I'm not saying that if there are closeted atheists in those areas that they shouldn't come out. I'm just saying that they're in a different situation than we'd be in, and we have to understand that. Positive humanism is not the same as positive psychology, and I'll be talking about positive psychology in a bit more, but my main contention against positive psychology is it tends to promote sort of a blame the victim approach. And it does that by just really focusing and stressing our personal autonomy, saying that we are in charge, we could make things, we could change things. And you know, that's great, and I certainly believe that. But there's also, as a social psychologist, there's that whole aspect that our environment and the social area that we're in and our situation, all of that affects our decisions, who we are and what we do. So there's a balance between that, and we have to recognize that balance. Positive humanism is not the same as humanism. Positive humanism and positive psychology, those are different. There's some conflicting ideas. But with positive humanism, there's nothing in conflict with humanism. It's just a subset of humanism. So just picture humanism in this big circle, and then you just have a little subset, a little circle within the circle that explains what positive humanism is. It just doesn't focus on what's wrong with religion, what's wrong with the government. There are no protests involved. There's no lawsuits in positive humanism. And these are all very important. Don't get me wrong. Without these elements of humanism and people fighting to remove religion from government and fighting the lawsuits, we wouldn't be able to sit on our nice little perch in positive humanism and be able to focus on the nice warm and fuzzy things. It's because of all the work that they're doing in humanism that gives us that freedom, if you want to call it that. And you can associate that with war, too. You know, war is a horrible thing. It's a terrible thing. But it's, you know, sometimes it's necessary. And we have to be thankful for the people who have fought that battle so we didn't have to, and so we could be where we are today. So I like to see positive humanism sort of in the same light. All right, I want to make it clear that I did not create positive humanism, okay? I just rebooted it. So I call it Positive Humanism 2.0. And this would be a very cool title, by the way, 10 years ago. But now it's kind of lame, I guess, with the you know, the Web 2.0 when that was big. I want to talk a little bit about the history of positive humanism. The first known usage, I did a lot of research on this to find out, you know, where's positive humanism been? How come we haven't heard much about it? The first known usage was in 1956 in an article in the Journal of Religion, where the author was describing a philosopher, Albert Camus, as a non-Christian thinker. And he, I quote, "who is preoccupied with questions of nature and meaning of men, their hopes, their possibilities, and their destiny." So you can see there's a lot of connection right there with humanism. So between 1956 and 1978, there was really not much going on, just some mention of positive humanism within magazine articles, within the scientific literature, but nothing much at all. Until 1978, when a gentleman named Dr. Gerald A. Leroux published an essay titled simply Positive Humanism. It was a short essay where he basically just talked about the joys of life, the joy of being a humanist, and what it means to him personally. And he expanded on that in a book that he wrote about 10 years later in 1989, it's called The Way of Positive Humanism. And it was an interesting book, but it was very personal to him, and he explained how he interprets positive humanism and what it means to him. So my goal here is really to pick up where the late Dr. Leroux left off, and I heard he just passed away a couple of months ago. Did anybody know him or know of him, by the way? I guess he was big in the humanist movement way back in the day. So my goal is to pick up where he left off and focus on the overlap. So as you can see there, our little chart, where positive psychology and humanism overlap, and that's the section of positive humanism. All right, now we get to talk about positive psychology. I know some of you have already told me that you're really into positive psychology. Who has heard of positive psychology before? And who, okay, a few people, who has studied it before? All right. So I'll give you a little primer on positive psychology and what it's about and why it's so important. Positive psychology uses the scientific method based on methodological naturalism, that is, no supernatural, which is basically what science is based on, to understand human well-being and flourishing. And this is a picture of Martin P. Seligman. In 1998, he was elected the president of the American Psychological Association. And he decided to do something a little bit different. Each president gets to bring with them a theme for their presidency and kind of where the industry is going to go. And he decided that everybody has been focusing on the negative spectrum of the mental health scale, you know, where you find depression, you find anxiety, you find psychoses. You know, that's all one end of the spectrum, and that's what psychology primarily focuses on. But he said, let's focus on the other half that's being totally ignored. You know, what makes people excited? What makes people excited to get up in the morning? You know, they want to live. They're passionate about life. Why aren't we studying that? And that's what he decided to do. Now, you may say, well, I've read about that before, and it's called the self-help genre. But that's different. This is the first time that they've attempted to actually take a scientific approach to these ideas and put it under the same scientific scrutiny that they would put, let's say, any kind of biological question under. And that's why it's different. But Martin P. Seligman, as much of an innovator as he is, he wasn't the creator of this idea. How many of you have heard of Abraham Maslow? Okay, that's a very popular name. Back in, I forgot when it was, maybe the 40s or the 50s, he was called a humanistic psychologist. So back then they didn't have positive psychology, they called it humanistic psychology, which was sort of the same thing. Maslow came up with this idea of the hierarchy of needs, the six different levels and sometimes the seventh. The seventh you don't hear about a lot, but it was one of his levels. The seventh was this idea of self-transcendence from a secular perspective, which is a wonderful idea if you ever get a chance to read about it. It's a way that we kind of continue ourselves onto this, like once we pass away, then the things that we've done on this earth kind of continue. The books we've written, the children that we've instructed, those are a part of us, and that's a way to kind of to embrace this self-transcendence. So he actually wrote about this many decades ago, but not much has been done since that. So that's when Martin P. Seligman decided to bring it back with this whole idea of the mental health spectrum being on the one side. So positive psychology is different from the self-help genre, not just because it's put under the scientific microscope, but for some very clear reasons. One, it doesn't confuse correlation with causality. Have you heard that expression before? When two things are correlated, like I don't know, there's so many examples out there, but a lot of times when two things happen at once, like if I think of a ghost and then something bangs in the back there, I'm gonna say, oh, the ghost did it. But no, I mean, it's something banged because a guy dropped something, you know, and I thought of a ghost. So there's correlation there, but it doesn't imply causality that the ghost actually did it. But that's very common in the self-help genre to imply that causality where none exists. A heavy use of anecdotal evidence. If you've read self-help, you'll read something from somebody who said, hey, I made $1 million and you can too. Just follow what I did and you'll be. It's like, no, I don't have the same talents as you do. I don't have the same circumstances. There's so many things that are different. It just doesn't work that way. But many people believe it does. And of course, the frequent mentions of the supernatural and mystical. You'll find that a lot in the self-help genre. And it's some of it is religious. I know Zig Ziglar was a very evangelical Christian. He worked a lot of that into his sales philosophies. But most of the kind of woo-ish stuff in self-help has to do with more of the mystical stuff. You know, there's like universal forces out at work, and just really mystical, strange stuff, and you have to believe it, and very positive thinking, crazy stuff, and it's interesting, a lot of fun. So let's talk a little bit about flourishing. You guys heard of the idea of flourishing before? Okay, flourishing can be defined as living within an optimal range of human functioning, one that connotes goodness, generativity, growth, and resilience. Flourishing is basically well-being. There's well-being, on the well-being scale, there's the negative end of well-being and there's a positive end of well-being. Flourishing is that positive end of well-being. Flourishing is also often used when it's, like in a sociological term, when it's talking about an entire society rather than a person, but it could be used both ways. So both of these things can be measured, and that's very important, because if human well-being and flourishing could not be measured, it couldn't be scientific, and it would be just another, some more woo or some more of that self-help stuff. But it can be measured, and we're getting very good at it. There are measurement instruments, tools, like kind of survey tests that are very carefully checked that correlate with somebody's actual well-being. So by using those kind of tools, we could actually measure the well-being, which makes it scientific. And of course, this is a social science, which is different than the hard science. And if you've heard that distinction before between soft sciences and hard sciences, that's the distinction. But some people have problems with that because everything is subjective, and that gets into a whole other philosophical debate, which we won't get into unless you want to in the Q&A, then I'd love to talk about that as well. Now, the big question is, are these two things compatible? Is positive psychology and humanism compatible? And I would argue a big emphatic yes. And the reason is because there's scientific evidence to back it up. Take Denmark, for example. There's a beautiful picture of Denmark. How many of you have been to Denmark? Yeah? Is it nice? Is it as nice as that picture? Or is that just like something on the postcards and the rest of it slums? I don't know. I understand that's a really nice place. A lot of Scandinavia is. But also, did you know that Denmark is consistently ranked the least religious country in the world, along with many of the Scandinavian countries? And coincidentally, or maybe not coincidentally, it's also ranked the country with the highest level of flourishing, of human well-being. Now, is that a coincidence? I don't know. I'm not implying any kind of correlation. I'm not implying any kind of causality. But what I am implying is that the two are certainly compatible. And we find that in many different parts of the world. Now, I know other religious people could say, well, you know what, I could show you different countries that are religious and have a good sense of well-being or different parts of the country, and they can, it's true. So instead of getting in this kind of battle back and forth of studies, I always say that what's really important is that we kind of live as an example. You know, we put on our best face, we live what we believe in, and our philosophy is reflected in everything we do, in our actions, in the way we treat other people, in the way we talk to other people. All of that is a reflection of us and a reflection of our philosophy. So I would love it when somebody comes up to you, and people have before, and they say, you know, you're just such a positive guy, and are you Christian? You must be Christian. I say, no, actually, I'm a humanist. I'm a positive humanist, and that makes me feel good. They say, wow, well, what is that? And I explain it to them, and it's a very soft sell. It's kind of like leading by example. And that's something we could all certainly do. I argue in my book that religion is a middleman to well-being. Now, as a social scientist and a humanist, I'm often conflicted because I like to follow the research and follow studies that talk about well-being and talk about religiosity. And I often come across studies that show that where there's religiosity and spirituality, well-being tends to increase as well. And that's pretty common. You know, and as a humanist, I say, damn it. Because that's the kind of fuel that people take, that religious people take and say, see here, this is proof that Jesus rose 2,000 years ago. I say, no, it's not. But they take that kind of information and they try to prove their beliefs associated with the religion. They see that as truth, but that's not the case. But now, again, as a social scientist, you can't pick out information and cherry pick and only pick the studies that support your particular view. You have to take everything. And then you have to make your decisions based on that. So I want to give you I'm sure most of you already know this here, but I want to spend just 2 minutes and give you a very quick little lesson on critical thinking when it comes to looking at headlines and trying to determine information on the internet, whether it's true or false. How many of you have been sent headlines from friends or family or whoever that where the headlines just look absolutely ridiculous? Anybody, or am I the only person here? And now you're thinking, how could they possibly send this? But believe it or not, there are so many people who actually believe it. All the way on one end of critical thinking, where pretty much it doesn't exist, you will see a headline, and you'll say, oh my goodness, wow, Snoopy landed on Mars, wonderful. And then you'll go ahead and retweet it, or you'll go ahead and Facebook it, and that's it. That's enough for you to actually believe. There's no critical thinking involved in that, folks. But believe it or not, a lot of people do that. Now, if you want to take it one step further, you say, okay, Snoopy landed on Mars, wonderful, let's read the article. So you read the article, you read all the details, and then you go ahead and tweet it. Well, you know, that's still okay, it's better, but it's not that good, because what you're reading is you're reading an interpretation. Somebody's a journalistic interpretation or a blogger's interpretation, who doesn't have the same editorial process as say, like a journalist, and they're writing about something, injecting their own biases and their own beliefs. Now, to take it the next step, what you could do is you could look for the reference in the article and find the scientific journal that it's from or where the claim actually is from and go directly to the source. Now, in the scientific literature, there's something called an abstract. Basically, you could always read the first, like a summary. It's like one paragraph of the whole scientific article, and you could read that for free on the internet, anywhere. And from that, you could get a lot more information. And a lot true information. You could see the results of the study, and then you could come to a conclusion there. And that's great. If you want to go to the next level, you could actually read the entire article. And this is where you find important things like the limitations of the study, where the researcher will say, well, you know, that we had a lot of limitations. We couldn't do this because of that. We couldn't do this. And when you start understanding the limitations, you start to realize that, well, how could they come to that conclusion with that much certainty? You can see that there's some level of probability, but not as much certainty as the journalistic spin made it seem like. And then, of course, you could even take it to the next level, and you could read what's called meta-analyses. That's when you take a whole bunch of studies on one topic and put them all together, and then you could see what the research shows like in some, and that's probably the best. But bringing this, the point is that a lot of these studies that show religion being this panacea for well-being, what they're doing is they're looking at the headlines and they're not going into the studies, and that's what I want to get into. Because once you do, you find out and you understand that religion really is just a middleman to well-being. What I like to say is religion is a means to an end, and that end, I argue, is well-being. And with a little knowledge, a tad bit of effort, we can bypass religion and get a better deal. And the better deal is positive humanism. Now, religion, just like many different middlemen, they do add value. Religion adds value. If it didn't, it would be kicked out of the marketplace a long time ago. But it does add value. It adds value, I think, one of the major ways is the whole idea of prepackaging a whole bunch of these beliefs. Just think about Christianity. It had almost 2,000 years, probably more like 1,700 years, to massage this story. To create this story, to put these little pieces of the puzzle together and make something that's internally consistent. And when I say internally consistent, I mean that you could look at Christianity, if you accept all the beliefs, then you could see how it can make sense. But once you start comparing that to some external factors like science and sometimes reality, then you start to say, uh-oh, you know, it doesn't make that much sense anymore. But generally, if you stick within a certain framework, then you could stay internally consistent. Now, religion does tend to attract certain personalities. People who are not open to ambiguity, people who really like things certain, and they don't want to know that, oh, geez, you know, I don't know what happens to me when I die. I just don't know. Some people aren't comfortable with that. I don't know. Some people need, look, I need to know. Just tell me. And even if it's not 100% true or even if it's not at all true, there's no evidence whatsoever, they will cling on to that belief because that's just part of their personality. They like to be certain. Some people are like that. And also some people are prone to magical thinking. Magical thinking is this whole idea that when two things are correlated, that there's some causation implied. And this is a part of personality. There are five dimensions of well-being theory. Martin P. Seligman, the guy we talked about, positive psychology, came up with the well-being theory a few years ago, because what was happening in the positive psychology movement was that so many people were focusing on this idea of happiness. Like, oh, we all got to be happy. Happiness is the key to everything. Happy, happy, happy. And people were blowing it out of proportion. And Martin P. Seligman, he recognized this, and he said, whoa, wait a minute. It's not about happiness. If you think about people who are out there protesting, out there fighting for rights, you know, people who are actually getting hit by batons, you think these people are happy? No. Do you think that they're very satisfied in what they're doing? Yes. You know, otherwise they wouldn't be doing that. They have this sense of accomplishment. And that's where there's this distinction between mere happiness and well-being. Well-being is made up of five different dimensions: positive emotion, engagement, relationships, achievement, and meaning and purpose. Or, for a cute little acronym, PERMA. Now, the key to this is that our wants and desires can be reduced to these aspects of well-being. All of our wants and desires, we could reduce them to one of these five aspects of well-being. That's the idea behind the well-being theory. So let's look at money, for example. People say they want money all the time, right? You want money, I want money, we all want money. But do we really want these little pieces of dirty paper that has germs covered on them and they're all crinkled and they smell and so many people have touched it and who knows what they did with it and has pictures of dead white guys on it? No, it's not the money we want. We say, okay, well, maybe it's the things that money can buy. But think about that as well, shoes. You know, these shoes. I bought money, I used money, and I bought my shoes. The shoes, you know, what do they do? They're just leather and rubber covering my feet. That's not what I want. You know, maybe I want fashion. Maybe I want the positive emotion that comes with wearing some nice shoes. Maybe I want somebody to say, hey, Bo, nice shoes. Which, by the way, I could care less about shoes. I'm just using this as an example. But it's the whole idea of positive emotion. And some people believe that if they have nice shoes that they may get attract a mate. You know, it's part of a relationship thing. So it could work on the relationship aspect of well-being. So ultimately, it goes down. We have money, we go to shoes, we go to positive emotion, and ultimately, it goes back to well-being. Now, we could look at this same thing with religion. I had the opportunity of speaking with a gentleman named Bart Campolo. He was a preacher, a Christian minister for a long time. Apparently, his dad is really big in the Christianity area. I didn't know that. But he explained to me something very interesting, and he was very eloquent when he did this. I won't be as eloquent as he, but at least I could try to explain it. He explained to me that the whole idea of buying into all these beliefs that he bought into. Oh, I should mention, if I didn't already, that he is now a humanist, and he doesn't believe anymore. And he explained to me that all these ideas and these mystical, supernatural beliefs, that's not what he was after when he bought into Christianity. But that was the price of admission. That's what he needed in order to get that well-being that came along with being part of that religion, that part of that community. The price of admission. I said, yeah, that certainly makes sense. I could see that. So if we look at religion and we look at the studies and the literature in the area, we could see that it's not religion that's directly connected to well-being. Religion is connected to different things. So if they look closer, they say, oh, well, you know what? It's church attendance. As more people attend church, that's where we see the increase in well-being. But then they looked even closer and they said, well, wait a minute, it's not just church attendance. What does church attendance actually give you? It gives you that sense of community, right? How many of you went to church at one point? Does anybody miss that? Yeah. I don't, but you might. But yeah, there are so many people that have this sense of community from church, and that feels great. And you could even take that sense of belonging, sense of community, and you can narrow that down even more to relationships, the relationships in your life. You know, those are some of the things that really make life worth living. And that comes down to well-being. So just imagine if we could skip the middlemen. We don't need the middlemen. We don't need to focus on religion. We don't need to do church. We just need to work on relationships. And we could work backwards from there. And say, okay, well, I like community. I like to get together like this. I'm looking forward to our discussion after. That builds a sense of community, builds my relationships. That is good. And we can make that decision without having to jump all the way to religion. Now, even positive humanism is a means to an end. It's just a more direct route. And as I like to say, it's definitely an awesome ride. I do want to talk about balance. This quickly, this idea of balance, because often I get involved in these debates, not really debates, but kind of debunking some of these ideas. And a lot of times these ideas are presented to me very emotionally, and they have a very emotional element and aspect to it. But if you look at it, if you take the emotion away and you look at it rationally, you could see that it's the argument itself is very fallacious, or the things that people are saying just aren't true. And in order to show them that, you kind of have to disassemble it from a critical standpoint. But when doing that, I often get accused of being like a Spock type of character, emotionally void. Like, oh, you have no compassion. You have no emotion. You're just total logic and critical thinking. And, you know, that bothers me. Well, it bothers me because I'm human and I do have emotions, you know, and I do feel things. But I ultimately think it's a complete and total misunderstanding. They are right. Some of the people who make these kind of criticisms are right in one aspect. They're right that a life devoid of emotion, imagination, passion is not much of a life at all. But they're wrong in the fact that some of these awe-inspiring experiences that we all have, religious and non-religious, do not require the suspension of rationality, the need to embrace the supernatural, nor the need to believe in something disproportionate to the evidence, which is often how faith is defined. Now, the best way to understand this concept and where I'm coming from is to use an analogy. Excuse me. The analogy is this idea of morality. Nobody would say to us in their right mind that, oh, you're too moral. You know, you need to go on the street and you need to find like a really elderly lady and you just need to kick her every now and then. Because you're too moral. You need to balance that morality with some immorality. And you know what? Rob a bank once a month. Why don't you? Because you're just too moral. You need more balance. People don't say that. Of course they don't say that. It would be ridiculous. And I argue it's ridiculous to say that we need to be more irrational because we're too rational. There's a different plane. When we look at actions could also be what's called amoral, which means there's no moral value associated with them. There are things that we do like brushing our teeth, we do push-ups, you know, if we walk. These aren't moral actions. These are considered amoral actions. So we could do those without any kind of moral value. The absence of moral behavior is not immoral behavior. That's the point. Now, in the rationality spectrum, we have something called irrational processes. And these are experiences that are not subject to rational scrutiny. These are, irrational processes are things like awe, you know, elation, love. These are irrational. We can't rationally understand them. And if we try to, we kind of destroy them. And this is the confusion that leads to the problems that arise when irrational experience is confused with an irrational belief based on that experience. And I'm going to give you two examples. The first one is this idea of the soulmate. This is the belief that we feel, you know, we feel love. Those of us who are fortunate to experience this feeling in life, and I'm sure I would think that most of us have, we feel love, and it's just such a wonderful, warm feeling. And we want to explain it. You know, it's difficult for us. I mean, we're very curious creatures, so we want to explain it somehow. So sometimes we turn to mythology, and we look back and we think about Aristotle and how he split the heart and split the soul in two, or the whole story, and I don't even know how it goes. But basically, it's the idea that there's our soulmate somewhere on this planet, the one other person, and that's what we do in life. We look and we try to find that one other person, and when we connect with them, sparks fly and magic happens, and that's our one and only person. You know, that's nice, that's fine. Until that other person passes away. And there you are, again, alone, without love, without somebody real to love. And some people who believe in this, they spend the rest of their lives saying, oh, I already found my soulmate, and they're already gone. And their well-being goes down, and they get depressed, and rightfully so. And some people die prematurely just based on that. It's been shown that that actually happens. But if you didn't hold that belief, that irrational belief based on that irrational feeling, then you would be open to finding love again. You'd be open and understand that, hey, oh, and by the way, isn't it coincidental that people find their soulmate like in high school? They're in the same town out of a world of 7 billion people. I always find that coincidental. Believing you know something you can't is not required to experience awe. In fact, it only robs people of more experiences, such as wonder and human curiosity. And the other example I was going to mention is the whole idea of religion, of course, pretending that you know something you don't. Pretending this whole idea that these wonderful feelings that we feel, like if you're up hiking in mountains and you're looking down at the world from 10,000 feet, it's just majestic. Or you're looking up in the sky and you see the universe and the stars, and you just have this incredible sense of oneness. You know, so some people, this is what spirituality means to some people. There's nothing mystical about it. There doesn't have to be anything mystical about it. But when you connect an irrational story to that and say, oh, you know what that feeling is? It's this guy who was killed he was put on the earth by his father, and then he was killed, but he's his own father, but he's actually his son, and he doesn't want you to use condoms. That's where that feeling comes from. This whole irrational story that are connected, it's pointless. And again, it robs from this whole human curiosity. So here's a great thing. What I like to do in this book is I don't just like to philosophize and just talk a lot of theory. I'd like to connect it to things that you could actually use in your real life. And this is one of those cases. When we have these irrational processes, when we experience these, the negative ones, such as anger, jealousy, grief, shame, fear, and even hatred, we can think about these. We can choose to think about these rationally. And once we try to dissect these irrational processes rationally, we could see that there's no rational basis for it. So, for example, if we try to say, well, why do we hate this person? Well, why? And you keep on asking why, and they say, well, why did that person do that to me? If I were in that person's shoes, and I had that very same exact genetic makeup, and I was in their same circumstances, and I was born where they were born and had their experiences, I would have done the exact same thing. And once you start rationally analyzing some of these negative emotions, they start to dissipate, and they could go away, and your sense of well-being could go way up. And when it comes to the positive emotions, I would say we choose to embrace those. We choose just to accept the love, to accept the kindness, the senses of awe and wonder, and don't try to rationally analyze it. You know, I think that is, as somebody who's heavily involved in critical thinking and psychology and science, I think that sometimes people do try to take these things apart when they really can't be taken apart. And instead of trying to do that, just accept them and say, hey, this is a human emotion. We're not just creatures of logic, but we're also creatures of emotion. And just accept it and embrace irrationality. So there are a few things that I really didn't cover because I just didn't have enough time. There are three main areas of my book that I'd be happy to talk about in the question and answer. And I'll tell you about those. One is the idea of a foundation for rationality. That was always an interesting philosophical argument or conversation to have. The other one is morality, secular morality. How could we explain a secular morality, and how could we explain it to others? And then the third is the whole issue of free will. Yeah, that's a fun one to get into. Those, again, each one of those could be an hour-long presentation, even longer, so I just didn't get into that. But I do want to leave you with just some ideas. First, that we don't live our lives based on remote possibilities. And that's one of the main differences between humanists or people who adopt a secular worldview, a science-based worldview, and somebody who would adopt a more religious or spiritual or something along those lines, whatever you want to call it, worldview. We live our lives based on realistic probabilities. And we learn to accept these probabilities, such as the existence of life after death. You know, we cannot say, none of us in this room could say with 100% certainty that the God of the Bible doesn't exist. Some people might argue on a logical basis there's conflicting information, but let's not get into that. But nobody could also say that after we die, there isn't some unimaginable existence that we will all experience, that we just can't even imagine now, that there's no evidence whatsoever in this lifetime to point to that. However, it will be there. None of us could say that. We just don't know. You know, that is a possibility. It's a possibility. But it's not a probability. We don't live our lives on these tiny remote possibilities. We live our lives based on probabilities, what will happen, and we account for those things. So this isn't practice. This is the big game. This is not rehearsal. It's both the opening night and the final performance. This is not some test, folks. This is real life. So put your game face on and enjoy the ride. Thank you. Okay, so where does positive humanism not overlap with humanism? Humanism itself contains a lot of different aspects and different elements to it. For example, the American Humanist Association is involved in a lot of activities, mostly legal activities, fighting for people's legal rights when government is being, injected with religion. And trying to get that part out. That's something that positive humanism is not focused on. Again, it's a very important part of humanism, very important part of living a secular life, but it's just not the focus of positive humanism. It will be. As you can see, I have a couple cameras set up, so I'll be doing some editing tonight. And I'll put it online tomorrow. I could send it to you, Maria, maybe, and you can get it out to your mailing list, put it on the website or something. I also have an online course that I put together on positive humanism that goes through my book in much more detail, kind of a slideshow with narration, and that's available for free. If you go to positivehumanism.com, that's where you'll find the website with all that information. And most likely, I'll put the video up there as well. I do certainly see value in the whole. And I think every one of us has individual talents that we could bring to virtually anything. The humanist movement or the secular movement, I feel that my talents are more in the positive spectrum. This is what I enjoy focusing on. This is what I enjoy doing. This is where I personally feel the greatest sense of well-being by focusing on this. And again, I've been there. I've been to the other end. And I would argue aggressively many times on a lot of different issues, and I'd fight with people, and not physically. If I did, I could still kick their butt, but I didn't. But I would get in a lot of confrontations, and I just didn't like doing it. I didn't like the person I was becoming. But there are people. That's my personality. There are people out there who not only could handle that sort of thing, but thrive on it. I know so many wonderful lawyers out there who are fighting for justice, and they love doing this. This is passionate. This is in their blood, and that's wonderful. That's them. This is me. And I think all of you here, you could see where you fit in, and you could say, I like this idea of positive humanism. I like focusing on this. I like showing the world how we could be very positive people, and we could be morally good people. And 53% of Americans right now will look at us in the room, those of us who are secular, which I'm assuming most of us are, and say that we cannot possibly be moral people. 53% of Americans, that kills me. That's heartbreaking. Because I just looking at you, I could see, there's so many just sweet faces here. And how could somebody look at you guys and say that these are immoral people? People who are evil. It just doesn't make sense. And I think by showing our values through the more positive aspect, people could kind of catch on and lead by example, and we could lead by example. Well, I don't know. There are certainly people, that is a good question. What will help most people kind of see things differently? And people respond differently to different techniques. There are some people who respond very well to ridicule, believe it or not. So a lot of those bumper stickers you see out there, like with the Jesus fish with legs, and even some a lot more aggressive type of communication, that works for a lot of people. You talk to people that were once believers, and they say, I didn't realize what I was believing until somebody pointed out the absurdity to me. And they pointed out in a very confrontational way, and I was mad, you know, I was pissed, but it helped me see the light. And other people will say, you know, that doesn't work for me. It happened when one guy just came up to me, he gave me a hug when I needed it, and I found out that he was a humanist. And wait, how could he care for me if he's not doing this for Jesus? And he explained to me how he's not doing it for Jesus, he's doing it for me. And that changes some people. All people are different. Well, again, the whole idea of optimism, pessimism, and realism and where that fits in, it's a little bit different than positive humanism. But I will address that point specifically, optimism and where it fits in. A lot of the criticism on the self-help movement, especially those books and authors focusing on this whole idea of positivity, they tend to overemphasize the positivity. And by doing that, if you are constantly being positive, you're not going to be a force for good in this world when it comes to addressing the things that need addressing, changing the things that need changing, because you're off in your own little world, you know, picking daisies and smelling the roses, and that might be all good for you, but for the rest of the world, for your brothers and sisters and your neighbors, these problems aren't getting solved. That's the problem that I have and many people have with extreme positivity. And I think it works well for some people. Like the whole idea of Buddhism, you know, kind of just finding yourself and centering yourself and just going off in some corner or going up on some mountaintop, just meditating for the rest of your life. That's not for me. You know, how could I do good for other people, for fellow humans, if I'm up on a mountain just with my eyes closed meditating the whole time? So it works for some people at an individual level, but I think more for a societal level, especially now and when we have all these, what used to be individual communities, now together in kind of like one global society. I think it's very important that we embrace optimism, but we also understand realism. And we understand when things need changing that they should be changed. Free will is an interesting thing in human behavior because, you know, on the one hand, if we are free to make choices, we're essentially free and we could do anything we want and we have a lot of autonomy, then it stands to reason that we are responsible for things that go wrong with us in life. You know, if we just choose to not get out of bed and not do anything and waste our lives away, then you could point to it and say, well, that's your fault. But some people take that too far. And they'll look at, let's say, a disadvantaged child that was born in the ghetto, and he was raised with parents on crack who weren't there, and he was raised by gang members, and they're surprised when he's out committing crimes. And they look at him and say, well, he could have put down that gun, he could have went to school, he could have done anything he wanted. And the question is, well, could he? Could he really have done that? And that is a very tough dilemma. It's tough because as humanists, we can't give everybody a free pass. Obviously, there's a spectrum here. There's a spectrum of control, what we can control and what we can't control. A lot of people take extreme stances when it comes to free will. They'll say either, no, we don't have it, and everything that happens to us is all a result of circumstances, cause and effect, and therefore, if we rob a bank tomorrow, it was meant to happen, no blame on anybody. Some people take another extreme stance, saying we are all complete free agents, we could do whatever we want, all we have to do is think it, and if we want it enough, we can get it. You know, that's a lot in the self-help industry. But that's not the case either. We find that the truth is very complicated. And in my book, I don't try to solve a 2,000 or 2,500-year-old mystery that's been argued by philosophers, Aristotle and Plato and everybody way back when. What I do is I explain what the science shows us today. The science of social psychology showing that we are incredibly all influenced by events around us, our behaviors, our thoughts, our actions, our beliefs, the things we believe, the things we think we have extreme control over, you know, we don't. We don't have as much control as we think we do. But here's the flip side to it. The whole idea of belief, if we believe in something, That is part of the causal chain. That is something that could get us to change and get us to do things. So if, and this has been shown time after time in all these different studies, people who believe in something, even if it's unrealistic, have a higher percentage of achievement on that thing just because they believe it. So this whole idea of belief is part of the causal chain. Now, sometimes we cannot step outside of our own causal chain, for example. So if somebody is stuck in depression, let's say, what we can do as humanists is we don't have to blame them for their disease, or we don't have to blame them for their circumstances, but we have to realize that we are agents of change. We are part of this causal chain in the universe. So we can make the conscious decision to go over to that person and help them, and help give them the information that they need to make the changes themselves. Because right now they're lacking that information. They're lacking the motivation. But we can change that. So we are certainly very powerful when it comes to bringing about change. And if we're trying to explain something on a very high metaphysical level, why that is, I say don't worry about it. I say it doesn't matter. What does matter is we can do it. And that's what's important. Well, let me talk about the first part, about Christian charities. In sociological studies, time after time, it has been showed that Christians are certainly the most charitable, much more charitable than their atheistic counterpart. Now, once again, if you look at the headlines, you're saying, oh, okay, Christianity, you must be right then. Christianity is better. But once you get into the details, you start seeing what's really going on. Just imagine if everybody comes together once a week and has a basket passed around in front of them with all their neighbors and family and friends watching to see what you're going to put in that basket. There's something called social pressure, folks, and that is a perfect example. And it's not only that, it's these Christian organizations such as churches provide the opportunity to give. They provide a weekly opportunity, and they make it very easy. And also, they put some pressure on you. A lot of churches will tell you it's a command from the Lord to give 10%. They'll quote the Bible verse and they'll say, when here's the basket, do what God tells you or suffer the consequences. So that's a possibility as well. But these are some factors that go into as to explain why Christians are more charitable when it comes to giving. But if you factor out those things, you will find that people, humanists and atheists, they're on the same level. So now the second part of your question about positive humanists, are they charitable? Well, right now I think you're looking at one of the only admitted positive humanists. Again, this is a new book, and I'm reviving a concept. The last positive humanist I knew died a couple months ago. Now I think I'm the only one left. So, I mean, I think people definitely will agree with this philosophy, but there's just not a name for it. So I don't know how to answer that. I think that everybody's unique in terms of their charity and how they like to give, but I still would love to see some kind of organization or organized effort. And I know there are many out there where humanists are more encouraged to give. And a Foundation Beyond Belief is one that I support. I connect to my website. They're a great charity that supports a lot of humanistic causes that I give to on a monthly basis. But what's interesting is they also support some religious causes that aren't in conflict with humanism. And I think that's a wonderful thing. There's a lot of the interfaith activity going on there.
Could you repeat the name of that foundation?
It's called Foundation Beyond Belief. And a gentleman named Dale McGowan runs it. He's a wonderful gentleman. Definitely look that up, foundationbeyondbelief.org.
Thank you.